Welcome, everybody. PersonalGrowth.net presents Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom.
Today, actually, we're doing a topic that, at first glance, isn't terribly relevant to positive psychology because the concept of shame is one that immediately brings on images of negative emotions and anything but positive emotions. But actually, as we look at this through the lens of Jewish thinking, there's a little bit of a deeper kind of set of lessons in terms of this value and this construct. Let me start with the psychological approaches. Basically, in social psychology research and clinical psychology, there's a very informative study that I think brings this out very clearly. Imagine somebody is walking down the street, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're in a really bad neighborhood, and a mugger comes out and mugs them so that they're, let's say, slightly injured, and they have all their cash taken away from them. So to the extent that there might be two responses, let's say you have 100 people who this happens to, and by chance, 50 blame themselves and say, you know something, really stupid thing I did. They're kind of ashamed about what they did. They say to themselves, this is my fault. And let's say another 50, by chance, accurately blame the mugger. They say, hey, listen, this is a terrible thing. A mugger came and mugged me and took away my money, and it's the mugger's fault. Strangely, if you follow this group of 100 up over a period of time, you'll see that those who do better psychologically are those who are in the group that blame themselves. Now, this doesn't mean that it's at all accurate if they blame themselves. Of course, it's the mugger's fault. But what it means is that there's a clear advantage to engaging in something that psychologists call behavioral self-blame, or really behavioral shame, meaning not that I'm a bad person, but that I did something that may not have been so smart. So when you look at things that way and you say, you know, I was mugged because I did something that maybe wasn't the smartest thing, why is it you do better? Because you know that in the future you'll be able to hopefully avoid falling prey to a mugger. So if you say to yourself, hey, listen, this was my fault. Obviously, you know that it's also the mugger's fault, or primarily the mugger's fault. But if you take an approach that behaviorally blames yourself and that you look at your role in it and say, hey, look, in the future, I'm not going to go in a bad neighborhood walking alone at 2 o'clock in the morning. So in that sense, you're going to feel more empowered and your psychological recovery is going to be much quicker than the person who says, well, this is completely the mugger's fault. Even though that person is more emotionally and morally accurate, they also are now at the mercy of fate. They're now in a place where they feel they have no control, where they feel like that piece of wood floating on a river at the mercy of the current. And this is, in essence, the difference between positive shame and negative shame. Positive shame, which is a very alien concept to Western ears, is something that the Musar masters and the experts in moral growth and Jewish thinking talk about. So let me talk about this, and let me just start with a quote from the Talmud, a quote that shows how Judaism views shame in the right context as a core component of actually a growth-oriented personality. Here's the words in Hebrew, and then I'll translate it. Mi she'ein lo boshes panim, somebody who doesn't have the capacity of shame, biyodua shelo amdu avosav al har Sinai, could not have stood with his fathers on Sinai, meaning that shame is an attribute that's seen as core and central to the Jewish identity. Now, what's that about? It's kind of a strange thing, especially given the Western view of shame as a negative characteristic that should be totally shunned. So let me go to the same Talmud, which is in the Tractate of Nedarim on page 76, on page 79A. Here's what it says. It says that part of a core Jewish identity is to be rachmanim, baishanim, and gomli chasadim. It's to work and possess the characteristic of being empathic and capable of having empathy and mercy for others, the capacity for shame, and the capacity for doing good for others. Now, then, the Talmud goes on to say, why? What is it about shame? Shehabusha mevia lidei yiraschet. Okay? What happens is this shame, somebody who has shame is more careful about doing that which is wrong, and therefore it's a good sign. Now, let's look at this in a deeper way. And again, let me give you the ending of that piece of Talmudic wisdom. It says, "Kol adam hamispayesh lo b'mehera hu chote." Any person who experiences shame and his ability to embrace shame in a positive way will not easily hurt others, will not easily sin. Now, one more piece of background from a Jewish text. And this is one from a master kind of a classic text in self-improvement in the Jewish literature, which is a 14th century work, anonymously authored book called Archos Tzaddikim, The Ways of the Righteous. And listen to how the author of this book views shame. Here's what he says. He says that shame is so core to developing the ethical personality that it serves as, he terms, mechitzas habarzel. It's an iron wall that allows us to not transgress. Now, how does one to understand that? I mean, it's one thing to say that there's such a concept as positive shame, but here you have one of the most pivotal works in self-improvement in the canon of Jewish literature, calling it the key barrier to sinning. So let's get psychological now, okay? And he goes on to say, let me just finish this verse. Al kein roi l'chol adam, therefore every person, and now I'll go to the English, one should exert himself to conduct himself in accordance with the noble trait of positive shame and employ wisdom in cultivating it until it is implanted in his soul. And listen to this, okay? Here's where he really gets to putting it at the center of his set of recommendations about leading an ethical life. He says, shame should be enthroned above all of one's impulses and should be regarded as more important than any other trait, for through it one attains most of the virtues and guards himself against all unseemly traits. Okay, now let's get to the practical implications of all of this. And I think that, let me start with just a basic biological fact. You know how in different cultures, different kinds of nonverbal communication differs. So the way one shows different kinds of emotions will be different in Asian cultures than in Western cultures. But yet there are only a few universal kinds of nonverbal actions. It turns out that across all cultures in the world, the way one manifests shame is by putting one's head down and averting one's eyes. It's universal. And it starts at a pretty early age. That's the way shame is seen. It doesn't matter if you're in Sri Lanka or in the Bronx. It doesn't matter where you are. That's the way shame is seen. Now, let's tie this universal manifestation of shame to the Hebrew word busha. Turns out the Hebrew word for shame, busha, has a incredibly strong moral and ethical lesson embedded in it. It turns out that it's tied to the Hebrew word yavesh, or dry, which means a break in the flow. Now, what does this mean? It means that the Hebrew word busha captures the essence of how positive shame can serve to erect the iron wall that the Orcho Sadikim talks about. Because what does it connote? Just like the nonverbal manifestation connotes, it connotes a slowing down, an inhibition, a pullback response. In another meeting, we talked about that wonderful quote from Viktor Frankl, between stimulus and response, there's the space, there's a pause. In that space lies our choice. In that space lies our growth. That pause, which sometimes is manifested through that pullback response, is really what positive shame is about. Turns out the Hebrew word busha means a break in the flow, or it's another word for hesitation or delaying. So, for example, when the famous story of the Jews sinning with the golden calf in Sinai is told to us, one of the words in the Torah is Vayar ha'am ki boshesh Moshe loredes min ha'har. The Jews saw that Moshe, our leader, was delayed in coming down from the mountain. And there are a few other places where in the Torah we see that the word busha is rooted in the word boshesh, which literally means a pause. It literally means what Frankl is talking about. It literally means a break in the flow, a pullback. Should I go out wearing that inappropriate dress, or should I pull back and have that setback response to ask myself, is this worthy of the image I want to project about myself? Should I engage in this behavior, or should I not? I was speaking last night to a group of adolescents about the dangers of drug abuse and substance abuse. And one of the things that I was talking about was the Nekudas HaBechira, which the Musar masters, the self-correction masters, would talk about, which means there's certain points in time that we're at a point of choice, a point of making a decision that you could go one of two ways. You could either take that drug or take that drink or give in to peer pressure or give in to the demands of the moment for momentary pleasure, or you could instead use that busha response, use that shame response, use that pullback response to evaluate and decide and make the ethical choice for which one would be proud. And that's basically what we're talking about. Why is it the positive shame is, as Orcho Sadikim, is chashuva mishar midosav, it's the most important trait to cultivate? It's because self-awareness and self-consciousness is something that makes us painfully aware of both our vulnerabilities and of our responsibilities. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, the well-known author and psychiatrist and expert on substance abuse in the Jewish community, has a common term he talks about. He also talks about how shame could be a positive character trait that serves to give us pause. Because listen, as we pull back from the flow of events that can sweep us into impulsive, improper behavior, as Rabbi Twersky says, we have to always ask ourselves this question before engaging in shameful behavior. Am I better than this? Does this behavior reflect who I truly want to be? In an earlier meeting, we talked about how getting in touch with one's goals, getting in touch with the core of who you are and where you want to go, is in some sense at the essence of one of the ingredients that makes us happy and makes us grounded and gives us a sense of purpose and direction. And in essence, it's this kind of positive shame, in quotes, that is a characteristic that maybe needs to be cultivated and embraced in a way that can allow us to ask the question, am I better than this, before it's too late. Okay, let me move on a little bit to talk about how this comes into the, literally into the canon of Jewish thought in a few other ways, because I just want to share with you a few other really interesting insights. Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, who's a brilliant thinker and writer who unfortunately died very young, but not before leaving an incredible number of brilliant books. One of his books that's a chapter is written where he talks about the connection between man's first experience with shame and the need for clothing. And there, Rabbi Kaplan quotes the medieval Jewish thinker and philosopher, the Abarbanel, and he points out that the word for clothing in Hebrew is levush, which is derived from the word lo bosh. We put clothing on so as not to be ashamed. And actually, the Talmud actually tells us this even earlier, and it's tied to the idea that we can marry this concept to the concept of even dressing modestly. Listen to this quote from a book on this characteristic, a monograph written by Ner Le'elef, a wonderful organization, who wrote about this feeling of shame and constructive shame. And I think it's worth an extended quote. Let me read it to you. Shame is the feeling of smallness when faced with a contradiction between one's superficial actions and his inner essence. Shame restores one's real identity. When a person feels shame, he or she will commonly say, I felt so small, I wanted to hide, or even I felt I could die. This is because when a person sees the wrong which he has done and is ashamed of it, it's as if the person is saying, I couldn't have done that. In the space where that transgression exists, my essence cannot exist. To the degree that I am faced with the transgression, to that degree, my essence is reduced. In that way, I separate my essence from the action and show that it was really the superficial me which did the action. So again, let's compare positive shame, which is the pullback response, the pause that makes us human and is the iron gate against doing that of which we will later be ashamed, and negative shame, which is what psychologists call characterological self-blame. So when a person says, look, I did something wrong, I'm a terrible person, I'm an awful person, and I deserve to be punished, and they get into this whole negative cycle of saying that their essence is bad, that's associated with all kinds of bad outcomes. The research clearly shows that's associated with depression, it's associated with actually a lowered likelihood of being able to act on one's wrongdoings in a constructive way. Or as social psychology research shows us over and over again, when we go from threat to challenge, we do much better. Earlier this weekend, I was at a retreat for families of children who have special needs. And it was a retreat that was really uplifting experience. And it was at a resort in the Catskills region of New York State, a beautiful resort where people get together for the weekend and talk about the challenges of having children with special needs, very often children who are so impaired that they literally have virtually no functioning. And it's a group of people who are under such incredible stress. And one of the things that came out repeatedly over the weekend as I talked to the parents is what they taught me about this issue. Many of them talked about how when they went through a period where they felt that somehow the reason why they were given a child of this with these tremendous deficiencies, they tell me when they felt it was a punishment, when they felt somehow that it was a message from God that showed that they were being judged, they just couldn't cope. They became more and more depressed, and they couldn't go on. When they made the transformation to, instead of seeing it as a punishment, to seeing it as a gift, seeing it as a way of learning how to have gratitude for the most basic gifts that we are given, it was transformative. I spent some time with this remarkably inspiring couple who have had a child who was so impaired that they worked literally day and night just to get this very impaired son to the point that he was able to sit up. And they wheeled their son over to me, and their son gave me this heartwarming smile. And you just saw them beaming with pride. And I realized that this child, who was now 10, really all that he could really do was sit up and relate to others with this very warm smile. Couldn't talk, couldn't communicate. They had to change him. They had to toilet him. They had to take care of his most basic needs. And yet they were literally filled with pride. And they said the secret was that they saw him as a gift that taught him how to be grateful for even the most basic kinds of behaviors that we tend to take for granted. And they said that they weren't able to come to this place till they went from that place of characterological self-blame, where they thought at some point that they were being punished by being given this child. Until they made the transformation of seeing him as a gift, they actually now say that he's the source of much joy in their life. This may sound hokey. It may sound almost like beyond attainment. But I spent the weekend with 50 parents, most of whom were going through the same kinds of struggle, and all of whom taught me that lesson. There's one more component to shame, and with this I'll end. And that's the bad kind of shame, not just the characterological self-blame that's associated with paralysis and associated with bad feelings of oneself as being damaged and punished, but also there's the Jewish approach to shaming others, how we view the severity of what it means to shame others. In a famous Talmudic saying, it says, "Kol hamalbin p'nei chavero barabim ki lo shofech damim." It says that anybody who shames a person publicly, it's akin to murder, which is an incredibly, incredibly harsh kind of statement. But then the Talmud goes on to explain in another very famous kind of warning about the severity of shaming others. Noach lo l'adam sheyapil atzmo l'chivshan ha'esh. It's better that a man throw himself into a fiery furnace than publicly put his neighbor to shame. Now, that's incredibly, incredibly harsh. What's that about? But it's basically what we know about the emerging literature on the severity of emotional abuse. I was involved in some research in my previous job, where I was director of psychology at a hospital, where we had an abuse center. And we had some federally funded studies where we looked at, among other things, a group of adolescents who had been physically abused, some of them so badly, were so badly beaten by their parents that they ended up being hospitalized. And one of the ways we looked at the data, we'd interviewed each of these kids and their parents for upwards of 12 to 15 hours to really get into the impact of this physical abuse. But one of the things we looked at was, and we followed them into adulthood, by the way, one of the things we looked at was what was worse, the beatings or the emotional tongue lashings that often accompanied the beatings. And it turns out that as we used various statistical models to tease this out, more than 90% of the negative impact of the abuse came from the emotional abuse, not the physical abuse. There's some new research coming out in the field of neuroimaging that shows that when somebody insults another person, the part of the brain that lights up is the same part of the brain that lights up when one is being physically assaulted. But I'll tell you, from the 25 or so years that I worked with various kinds of traumatized individuals, they almost always tell me that they far prefer the physical beatings to the emotional abuse. In the over 20 years that I co-led a group of women in a shelter for survivors of domestic violence, repeatedly the women would tell me that the worst part of their traumatization wasn't so much the beatings as it was the ways their partners would verbally harass them, make them feel small, and shame them constantly, both in the privacy of their bedroom as well as in front of the children and in front of friends. They said they'd far prefer a physical beating to the horrible feelings of damage that came from the public shaming or even the private shaming of emotional abuse. And even though our mothers may have taught us sticks or stones will break my bones but names will never hurt me, clearly the research is showing that names can hurt in a way that's even more profound than the bruises that come from a beating. And let me end today's discussion with a rather surprising and confusing statement by the great ethicist Rabbeinu Yonah. And here's what he says. He quotes the Talmud that I talked to you about, how if you shame somebody publicly, it's worse than murder. And then he goes on to say that one who shames a person publicly doesn't have a share in the world to come. And then he asks an obvious question, and I'll read it to you in the Hebrew. Umashelo amru kein al harotzeach. Why don't we say the same thing about a murderer? He raises a fascinating question. Even a murderer could repent. Even a murderer can have a place in the world to come. And why is it that we teach that publicly shaming somebody is so harsh a transgression that one doesn't have a share in the world to come? It doesn't make any sense that it's treated more harshly than a murderer. And he goes on to say something that explains it in a brilliant way. And I'll end today's meeting with a story that demonstrates this beautifully. He says the difference between a murderer and one who publicly shames somebody is ki hamalbin pnei chavera, one who publicly shames somebody, einenu makir godul chito. He has no recognition of the enormity of his sin. Ve'ein nafsho marolo al avono kamo harotzeach. And he doesn't have the regret and the compunction and the sense of sadness that comes from the realization of a murderer of the enormity of the horrible sin he committed. Al Kain hu rachok min hatshuva. He therefore never changes, and as a result, there's no hope for him. And let me end with a story. I was giving a lecture to a group of educators in a town in the United States, in the middle of the United States. And we were talking a little bit about the topic that we're talking about now, a little bit about emotional abuse and the enormity of how it could impact on somebody. And the principal told me the following amazing story. He said that the night before, there was a 25th reunion for the high school that he was principal of. And he was attending the reunion as the principal of the school, and it was a group of women gathered around who were old friends who hadn't seen each other for years. And suddenly into the room came a woman who who nobody had seen for 25 years since she graduated high school. She comes marching into the room, and she goes to the group of women near where the principal was standing, and she takes out what turned out to be her diary that she kept during high school, and she thrusts it at the woman who was the queen bee, the leader of the group of girls in that high school 25 years earlier, who had made her life miserable by teasing her and insulting her and making her feel like garbage. And she read to this woman as she showed her her diary, and to this group of women who now were middle-aged women. And she read to them, "Here's how you made me feel." And she reads one page. "You know, today they teased the dress I was wearing, these girls. I'm so depressed, I think I may kill myself later today." She then turns to the next page, and it gets even worse, where she talks about the degradation and the teasing and the bullying and the social exclusion and the feelings of isolation that she felt as a result of the kind of verbal bullying that she experienced at the hands of these high school girls. And she goes from page to page to page as the now middle-aged women look on in horror. She then takes the book away, and the former queen bee looks at her in horror and says, I'm so sorry, but I literally don't remember any of this." And the principal raised this story as an example of exactly what Rabbeinu Yonah taught us many hundreds of years ago, which is the idea that very often, especially with younger kids, there's a lack of recognition of the way shaming others can literally destroy a person's soul. And because one is kind of tied up in their own world and their own insecurity, they don't realize that they've committed soul murder. And this explains why in Jewish thinking, in Jewish law, it's viewed as such an incredibly harsh and serious kind of crime. So to pull this together, we're talking about positive shame and negative shame. Negative shame is the characterologic self-blame that can lead the parent of a special needs child or the victim of a crime to blame themselves and to feel increasingly paralyzed and to have an incredibly difficult time. It's paralyzing. It's not associated with anything other than feelings of threat and depression and inability to act and move on. And clearly, that's not something that we want to have. And clearly, when we commit the terrible transgression of giving and transmitting shame to others, it's literally viewed in Jewish thinking, metaphorically, as a capital crime. On the other hand, there's the very same trait is associated with the cornerstone of building character, busha, which is the Jewish concept of shame, is positive shame. It's the iron barrier that can lead for us to pull back. It could be the pause. It could be the space that has us think before we act, check our future actions against our internal ideals and internal goals. And we all know that when we do that and we occupy that pause between stimulus and response, with that pullback response in a way that we then ensure that we live up to our own internal standards and our best selves, that we emerge to develop into the people that we dream of becoming. Thank you.
Thank you for joining PersonalGrowth.net, Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom, by Dr. David Pilkovitz, Ph.D.